I don't know if all of you were here for Abhay's talk a month ago, more or less, in which he presented the geometrical aspects of this analogy between scry and a weakly isolated horizon, or more in general, more simply, a non-expanding horizon. Non-expanding horizon represents black hole horizons or cosmological horizons, whereas scry is an horizon in the unphysical metric, which from the point of view of the physical metric is infinitely far away. Nonetheless, as Abhay shown, they share many geometrical properties, and in fact their geometry and their physics can be understood in a unique way by just writing a single equation and the same geometrical object, and then seeing how Einstein's equations in one case and the conformal Einstein's equations in the other case dictate the completely different physical behaviors of these two geometrical surfaces. And then he stopped short of telling you how this unified framework is also useful to describe charges and fluxes for scry and a non-expanding horizon. And that's what I would like to complete today, together with some other work that I've also recently been doing. So today's talk will be based on scry as a weakly isolated horizon paper with Abhay, and the paper Covariance and Symmetry Algebras with Antoine Regnon-Bray, who might be visiting for a few days at the beginning of May, and you might have seen when he visited in November. He's a PhD student in his last year in Marseille. And the plan of the talk would be that first I would like to show you how we derive the flux balance laws, if you want, how we derive fluxes and charges, a la Abhay, so to speak. By this I mean basically following the procedure that Abhay and Michael Stroebel introduced in 81, and which in this paper, so another AS but different AS, we extended. This was for the whole of scry, we extended it to finite regions of scry. And then I would like to compare these with the probably more famous and more familiar Wolff-Zupas procedure from the famous paper in 99. And so basically most of the stuff here is 40 years old. The stuff here is more than 20 years old. I will hopefully have something new to say, which will be about this role of covariance in particular, and co-cycles. And this is this newer paper. And in the process of doing this, I hope my goals will be to clarify the relation between these two things, clarify some aspects of the Wolff-Zupas paper, that when people say that the paper is great but is obscure, they are right. It is not so easy, but it can be made, it can be unobscured, and it's a very good paper. And also, my goal would be to try to, for those of you familiar, more familiar with the Bondi description of these things, I would like to talk to you about why these quantities transform in this seemingly funny way, and why this is the unique char prescription that one should consider for the BMS group. The whole talk will only be about the BMS group. I'll be happy to discuss about extensions at some other time, but for this talk, it will only be BMS. Okay, and maybe the starting point for both these approaches would be just to be in more explicit and familiar grounds, just to use these Bondi coordinates, which, if this is scry, foliate spacetime with a family of u equal constant null hypersurfaces, so this is a null foliation, and then we take an affine parameter along, or not necessarily affine, it might be an area parameter along these null geodesics, which is given by R, and then we have coordinates on the cross sections, which are just spheres, which I'm going to call xA, and this can be theta and phi, for instance. So in these Bondi coordinates, one can write a generic expansion for the metric in the limit to scry, which is identified as r going to infinity. And the usual parameter, well, people tend to have slightly different parameterizations. This is the one I'm going to use. So there's a time-time component of the metric where the mass of a Schwarzschild black hole will appear if you use Bondi coordinates for the Schwarzschild spacetime. And then if you use the same coordinates for Kerr, this is where the angular momentum will appear. And then for the 2D component of the metric, you have this expansion here. This leading order of the metric, I'm going to call it Q. This defines some 2D derivative and 2D scalar curvature. This 2D scalar curvature is what appears there. And this 2D derivative is what appears, for instance, here. And I will explain what the other terms are. And this can be, in general, an arbitrary metric for the cross sections for these two spheres here. So these are the coordinates that most people use. There can be slightly different variation in the parameterization, but this should be the most common ground that one can have. And then if you want to talk about phase space at Scry, one very simple thing that we can do, and both Wolzupas and Abai's approach use, is the covariant phase space. And so what we're going to do from the covariant phase space is start with the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. And I'm going to take no cosmological constant so that I can go to Scry. So this is just 1 over 16 pi r as a four form. Epsilon would be the four volume. And then you take the variation. And on shell of the equations of motion, you get just a boundary term. And this boundary term, we call it the symplectic potential current. The actual symplectic potential will be the integral of this tree form on some Cauchy slice. And so what we're interested in is in the phase space at Scry. So what we can do is to take theta, which we can read from that action, and send and take the limit to Scry. This limit is actually finite. And it gives the following expression. So theta, let me call it Einstein-Hilbert, so the one associated with this Lagrangian, is in those coordinates, in that parameterization, you get something like this. Let me not specify yet what B is, because anyway, insofar as the phase space is concerned, B doesn't matter, because the phase space is constructed out of the symplectic 2 form. And the symplectic 2 form is delta of theta as a current before integrating it over. And therefore, this B drops out, and you just get this part here that matters. Now, the point is, what does this mean? What are these quantities here? They're just metric components. So it's hard to give it a physical interpretation in terms of arbitrary coordinates. It's nice to give a little bit more geometrical meaning to these quantities so that we know what we're talking about. I mean, this is just like saying that, you know, when you say that the mass of Schwarzschild is M, you shouldn't say the mass of Schwarzschild is, you know, the 1 over R component of the GTT metric component, because you could change coordinates and get arbitrary results, right? You should give a geometric meaning to what is the mass of Schwarzschild. And then in some specific coordinate system, you can interpret it as that component. So that's what I would like to do for those terms there. And these partially uses, so I'll be back, I'll come back to this later. So this partially uses what Abai has already presented, namely the covariant description of Scry. Covariant description of Scry. So the first rule of this game is that actually R is a poor choice of coordinates if you want to talk about Scry, because it sits at R equal infinity. So if you want to do differential geometry at Scry, that would be a really bad choice to begin with. So one thing you can do is to change coordinates and introduce a coordinate omega, which is 1 over R. And now you can think of this omega as a conformal factor that compactifies the metric to one in which Scry is at a finite distance. And this is what this covariant description formalizes. So we introduce an unphysical metric given by omega squared g mu nu, where omega equals 0 identifies Scry, and we're going to make some assumptions. First assumption is that Scry has this topology, for instance, that the metric is smooth. One can discuss about these assumptions, generalize them, but for the sake of this talk, it doesn't matter. It will be not necessary. We can stick to the simplest possible thing. And then the normal to Scry, I can define it as the gradient of omega. I define it like this everywhere. And I will require that Scry is a null surface. Sorry, I should have said that too. In fact, there's actually no need to require it, because if you use the conformalized Einstein's equations with appropriate Folov conditions on the matter fields, then you get it for free. That Scry is a null hypersurface. Just to fix the notation, I like to use mu for the spacetime indices and A for hypersurface indices, which in this case will be Scry. So just u xa. So this capital A is now just the coordinates on these cross sections here. This is useful because some quantities are defined only on Scry. And so it's nice to keep in mind different indices so that you don't tend to interpret objects which are defined only at Scry as bulk objects. Once you have defined this unphysical metric here, and you switch to coordinates omega u theta and phi, then you can take the pullback at Scry. And so using these coordinates, this pullback, let me say that this has only coordinates a and b, this pullback. And I'm going to call this QAB, and this is a null-induced metric, which in Bondi coordinates, you can see it takes the form delta A, delta B, QAB. Okay, so this is a special form in Bondi coordinates. So it's nice to have the covariant description on the one side and specialize to Bondi coordinates, because it helps making things more concrete often. So this is the so-called unphysical metric. And the other thing that is useful to remember is that because this vector is null, I can now raise indices using the spacetime unphysical metric. So this is my vector. And this one is tangent to Scry and null. So because it is tangent to Scry and null, it induces a vector NA because it's tangent to Scry. And this is, and because it's null, this is the vector that is annihilated by QAB. So QAB and B equals 0. Sorry. And in this, yeah?
Wouldn't you write N mu equal to? Sorry, I don't see the N.
Because there are.
Because there is an N.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. A few things were missing there. Excellent. Thank you. Yeah, you raise this, see, because this is a spacetime metric and physical, so everything is well defined at Scry. You define this, but then you see it's tangent, so actually you can just interpret it as a 3D vector, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so you see that this is a background structure. There's no physics in this. So this is a pure background or kinematical quantity. It's a choice of conformal factor, which we can take it to be 1 over R, but we don't have to. In fact, in this covariant description, there's infinitely many omegas that you could take. In particular, if you have given a certain omega, you could change to any other omega given by some quantity that is just not zero at Scry, so it doesn't change the order. And this would be another good conformal factor. And if you do this, you see that QAB would change into omega squared QAB. And because the vector n is defined with the inverse here, you also see that nA will change like this. So basically, we have this kinematical structure, which is an equivalence class of pairs, where the equivalence relation is this one. And now this is already very interesting, because it says that the background structure. Okay, so then you can ask whether this background structure has isometries. So for instance, you know, let's think of relativistic field theory in Minkowski spacetime. For relativistic field theory in Minkowski spacetime, there is a background structure. Background structure is the metric of Minkowski spacetime, so eta mu nu. The isometries of this metric are the Poincaré transformations, and they give you very useful symmetries for your relativistic theory on Minkowski spacetime. So here, in this general relativistic context, the boundary we have introduced at infinity comes with some background structure that allows us to define these quantities. And now we can ask whether there are diffeomorphisms that are isometries for this background structure. So then we can think of them as symmetries, just like those diffeomorphisms that are isometries of the Minkowski background are symmetries for relativistic field theory. So diffeos, which are isometries of this background structure, are symmetries. Now, notice that this is just one definition of symmetries. Because diffeos are usually considered gauge, you might ask about another definition of symmetry. Maybe, how about degenerate directions of the symplectic two form, which become non-degenerate directions? So to promote gauge transformations to symmetries. That's a very good point, and it can be answered in a consistent way. So I'll come back to it shortly. But if I take this other definition, forget about this, is a pre-symplectic definition, if you want, of symmetries, just as isometries of some background structure. And then, what does it mean to find the isometry of this? Because this is an equivalence class of conformal transformations, it means that you want those diffeomorphisms that act as asymptotic conformal killing vectors of this physical metric. Now, in general, given an arbitrary metric, there are no conformal isometries. So it's OK, there are no symmetries. The thing is finished. But precisely the definition of asymptotically flat makes it possible to have asymptotic killing vectors. And so this group of diffeomorphisms which are satisfying this property is not empty. And it's actually called the BMS group. And it's a subgroup, of course, of the diffeomorphisms of N. And this subgroup, if I use, maybe just algebraically, in general, this subgroup has the structure of SL2C times supertranslations. And just to explain what that is, in these parametrizations of Scry with u, theta, and phi, an arbitrary diffeomorphism on Scry would be something like this, xada. So an arbitrary function u plus an arbitrary function dA. And the restrictions required in order to preserve this conformal class of this background structure is that xiA is time independent. By time, I mean this u, this null time. And so I'm going to call this time independent xiA, I'm going to call it y. So this is only a function of the sphere coordinates because it's time independent. And for u, a time dependence is allowed, but only linear. So the condition u is that double dot has to be 0. And so we have this function f that has an arbitrary function on the sphere plus an arbitrary a priori function here. But then the condition that n, if I do this condition, if I require the preservation properly, I also get another restriction, namely that this f dot has to be related to these y's as follows. F dot has to be 1 over 2 divergence of y. Okay, so these are the parameters for this BMS group. And the interesting thing is that this BMS group looks very much like a Poincaré group, which is what you would like, because at asymptotically space-like infinity, we have a Poincaré group. So why does it look a little bit like that? Well, because SL2C is isomorphic to the Lorentz group. And if you restrict these supertranslations to, you know, some four special modes of them, then you will have also the translations of Poincaré. But it's not the Poincaré group for the two reasons that, first of all, you have the supertranslations, so not just arbitrary sorry, not just translations, but arbitrary time point-dependent translations. And also the other difference, which is related to this, is that you don't have just, you have a lot of ambiguity in picking up the Lorentz subgroup of this subgroup, of this group here. So let me maybe explain that a little bit. I'm going maybe slightly too fast. So if this was an Euclidean three-dimensional space, then we know very well what it means to be Cartesian, because we have a flat metric everywhere, and we know what are the transformations between inertial observers. But the problem is that this metric is flat, but has a degenerate direction. And therefore, this line is geometrically exactly the same as this line. And so there's no sense in saying that you got, no, this guy is inertial and this guy is not inertial. They are indistinguishable because these directions are degenerate. And so those global translations that we can, if we have a non-degenerate metric, identify as special ones in Euclidean space, we can no longer identify as special ones here in general. And therefore, we have this additional freedom to make deformations like this. So pointwise translations, which is this part of the symmetry group. There is nonetheless, so this group contains a unique subgroup of global translations, as opposed to super translations, but there's no unique subgroup of Lorentz transformations.
Simon?
Yes.
Sorry, just one question. When you move from this slide to that slide of the presentation, so when you wrote the generators...
I'm changing conventions?
No. I was wondering whether you pick a particular n.
Yes, so I think this, Abai explained, Scry allows, so this is where, so the symmetry groups of a weakly isolated horizon is actually different than the symmetry group of Scry, and that's because on a generic weakly isolated horizon, you cannot pick up a unique choice of n, whereas at Scry you can, because for a given conformal compactification, you have this preferred choice of n. So we fix that once and for all. Okay, so yes, I picked that once and for all. Then this n here is whatever it is. If you use those nice coordinates, the good thing is that in these coordinates, n is just du. And so that's why I'm writing things like dots instead of, because otherwise, if you, more in general, these things you should write li n of f is equal to, okay?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, here I'm using Bondi coordinates.
Okay.
Okay, now, so maybe we can talk more about the BMS group, but I didn't want to talk about it too much, just giving it for granted a little bit. What I wanted to, on the other hand, indulge a little bit more on is the fact that this huge redundancy in choosing omegas can be actually tamed a little bit. So there's a huge freedom in choosing omega that can be tamed. So the first typical thing that people do is that to choose divergence-free frames. So that means choose an omega such that the divergence with respect to the unphysical metric of n mu is equal to zero. And this gives you many things, because then you use the Einstein's equations. And from this, you learn that in particular, Scry is a non-expanding horizon. So it has zero expansion and zero shear. You also learn that Li n of QAB, the induced metric, is zero. And because it's a non-expanding horizon, that means that the pullback of this unphysical connection, so let me just call it A, is actually gives you a connection on Scry, which let me call it D, big D of A. In general, the space-time Levi-Civita connection does not give a well-defined connection on an Alleper surface because there's no projector on an Alleper surface. So what you have to do is to pick a foliation of your Alleper surface, and then you can actually project on the leaves of these foliations. But that gives you, and that gives you now a well-defined connection, but which depends on your choice of foliation. But if your Alleper surface is a non-expanding horizon, basically this procedure becomes independent of your choice of foliation, and you have a unique connection. So this is what in these old papers of Abai was all about. The connection description of Scry was about was based on this simple fact, and so it uses this choice of restriction on the frames. And when you write it like this, this is sometimes also referred to as Bondi condition. Notice that the a remark I wanted to say here is that the symmetry vector fields psi, so those guys there, are defined intrinsically to Scry. The extension you pick of them off of Scry can be arbitrary. You can pick whatever you want. You see, the characterization of the symmetry group has nothing to do with your choice of coordinates in the bulk. Can be done intrinsically at Scry in terms of this universal structure. Another restriction, yes?
You mentioned coordinates. Yes. Maybe you want to avoid talking about it, but you have to choose some coordinate on the sphere. Of course, if I make a...
Pick any.
Yeah, so different coordinate on the sphere will lead to completely different...
Completely different representation of this guy, yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. In fact, in general, you know, you would only write this as some component along n and some horizontal part, which depends on your choice of foliation. But this depends, everything you can write in arbitrary coordinates of Scry, it's very convenient to use u, ted, and phi, or u, z, and z bar, but typically when you do the extensions, but let's say everything when you write it like this is coordinate independent on Scry.
That's what I wanted to say.
No, this, the characterization of the group is completely coordinate independent.
What I mean is that you have to choose, as you know, if you define a round metric, a round sphere metric, you can take a diffeomorphism of the sphere and you get another round sphere metric.
Okay.
So, you know, between round sphere metric one and round sphere metric two, these are different.
What they can be also conformal transformation, not just
I'm talking about the conformal. I'm talking about just diff s.
Yes.
Right? So,
yeah.
So apparently there's kind of an infinite number of...
Of course, yes.
Okay. So it's one choice and then you stick to it.
Like, so it's a
particular...
To characterize the group algebraically, you don't have to pick any. In fact, this doesn't even need to be a round sphere. You don't need to pick coordinates on Scry. Deriving that this is the symmetry group, and you will see to largest also deriving the charges and fluxes does not require you to make any choice of coordinates on Scry. Although in practice, it's very convenient to do so. And that's why I like to have both the covariant picture in which you don't need to pick any coordinates, but then a very explicit, but it's important to keep these two things in mind. For practical calculations, it's always convenient to pick coordinates, but it's useful to describe the things that don't depend on choices of coordinates. We'll come back to this in a second when we talk about the difference between the news and the shear, because that's an obvious example in which this occurs. Now, another restriction that people always do is to, as Laurent just said, use round spheres. So this, let me denote this special case with a little zero or O, and this is such that R equals 2. So R little dot equals 2. And these are called Bondi frames. Now, don't blame me for Bondi condition and Bondi frames. It sounds so similar, but they have nothing to do with one another. okay? So Bondi frame means that. Bondi condition means this. Now, you can do whatever you want. These restrictions are not going to change the physics, are not going to change the symmetry group. They're not going to change anything. However, it's interesting to discuss which one is convenient and which one is not.
Can I ask another question?
Of course.
If you didn't have round spheres, we had some weird metric that was a diff.
Yeah, this is the standard case.
You wouldn't have a BMS though, right? Because you would have a smaller symmetry group with S.
No.
The difference is
whether you allow your symmetry group to change these or not.
No, but we say that that's the equivalence class, then SL2C acting on...
The equivalence class of this is just the BMS group, no matter what the metric is.
Really?
Yes.
You'd have SL2C if it was a rotationally invariant metric.
Yes. Yes.
Is that true?
Absolutely.
That's
the, but this is the reason why you really don't need, so if you want, do you remember maybe this equation here? Maybe it will be more familiar to you. You see, delta xc of QAB, if you do BMS, so these are conformal Killing vectors,
yeah,
gives you zero.
I still thought that they relied on the,
no,
like the leading part of the metric, the sphere metric.
No,
around, right?
No, 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 absolutely. It can be whatever you want. It can be, no, this is very important. And why it is very important?
Super translations, but that L psi y wouldn't be zero on QAB, right?
What is non-zero?
So like
no,
the leader of the long
one. I think the y are chosen should start.
So if your q, if your q is around sphere, this guy will preserve the fact that it's around sphere.
Okay.
If it's not around sphere, it will not preserve the fact that it's around sphere.
Right. Okay.
So that we agree. If you write li y of r,
yeah,
this is zero if this was constant.
Yeah.
It remains zero. So of course, if you start with round spheres and restrict to round spheres,
yeah,
you get the BMS group,
yeah,
as a symmetry group, but you don't have to. And why is it interesting not to restrict to round spheres? Because you might ask this question, okay, why is it good not to restrict to round spheres? There are actually two very important reasons why you can do it, but it's convenient not to do it. But first, let me say this one. Because, you know, for those of you that come from Glenn's school, he likes very much to give this up, and that's fine, but it makes a lot of things much more complicated. A lot of equations simplify thanks to this. In particular, the equivalence class reduces to conformal transformations which are time independent. So if you do Bondi condition. And this, a lot of calculations become much easier. On the other hand, you know, Glenn doesn't need simplification in the calculations because he's so good. So actually in his papers, he doesn't need that, and he does everything without this assumption. So you can do that. The classical motivations to do it remain a little bit open and to be discussed. For the rest of this talk, I'm assuming that I've done this. For that one, it's a little bit more interesting why one can do it, but usually does not do it. And I personally found two reasons compelling. The first one is that, as we will see, you end up writing things that depend on this background structure. And so to make sure that things are covariant, you want them not to depend on your choice of conformal factor. That means that you're going to require for some conformal conformal invariants of your quantities. Now, conformal invariance is simple to study if your conformal transformation is arbitrary. But if you ask if your conformal transformation preserves round spheres, then it's tricky, because the conformal factors that preserve round spheres satisfy a complicated differential equation, and therefore you don't see immediately the conformal invariance of the quantities you're writing. So one reason, no, so can always be done. But not always convenient. And one reason is that checking conformal invariants becomes harder. And the second reason has to do about checking the flux balance angular momentum law for arbitrary cross-sections. So this is very old stuff, but I think it's sometimes forgotten, so it's nice to briefly mention it, so I'll hope that I can. So anyways, just bear with me that when you do this calculation, there are two practical reasons why it's convenient not to do it, but it is true that you can do it, and you don't lose any physics, you don't lose anything in the symmetries, so that's clear. Okay, that said, so having said this about the BMS group, okay, now I wanted to go back to that. How can we give some physics to those, or geometry, to those metric components? And so for this, let me talk about gravitational radiation at Scribe briefly. And the way this was constructed, to the work of, you know, Bondi, Sachs, Penrose, Newman, and plenty of others, at the end, probably the nicest description is the one that is in Gerock's book. And so basically what you do is that you look at vial components that are outgoing at scry, and you discover that these, you can write them in terms of the unphysical Skouten tensor. What does this mean? Well, this means that you look at the Riemann tensor for the unphysical metric, and you construct the Skouten tensor, which is just RAB. Sorry, everything should be four-dimensional here. Everything is four-dimensional. Minus 1 over 6, R unphysical, and G mu nu. Now, this guy contains the physical information you want, but is not conformally invariant. In other words, it contains also unphysical information. So you cannot use it just to extract what is the gravitational radiation being carried away. So you have to make this conformally invariant. And this is what Gerock found. There is a unique and universal tensor that carries his name. And this is defined only at scry. And this is such that it transforms in the same way as this guy pulled back on scry. So this is such that this tensor here is conformally invariant. That's easy to check. What is much less easy to check and very tricky is that this tensor is also traceless. Another thing that is easy to check is that it's transverse. And that means this. Because it's transverse and traceless, it only has two components, just like the physical degrees of freedom of GR. So that's great, because that's a characterization, that's a physical characterization of gravitational waves, which is obviously completely covariant. This is a tensor of scry, so it does not depend on choice of coordinates. It does not depend on choice of foliations of scry. And it does not depend on the choice of conformal compactifications, because it's conformally invariant. So the problem of gravitational radiation is very neatly solved by looking at this guy. And now we can just, for the purpose of identifying this, we can just take this expression, evaluate it on that metric there, in Bondi coordinates. Guess what you get? Well, in Bondi coordinates, you get that this guy, well, transverse in Bondi coordinates, because in Bondi coordinates, n is just du. So transverse basically means that NAB boils down to just NAB components. The UA components are zero. And then you evaluate it for the metric, and you get minus C dot minus rho traceless part. Now, this Gerock tensor has the characteristic that this traceless part is zero on round spheres. This metric.
I mean, you use the Bondi frame.
Not yet, because otherwise this would be zero. I'm using that form of the metric, which uses Bondi coordinates, but an arbitrary frame. Well, not arbitrary, it's still Bondi condition.
There's twist, you have a term, it's more complicated.
No, I know what twist you're talking about. That you don't have it here, I'm telling you. Okay, very nice. Since you raised this question, I'll tell you why. No, there's no. Okay, but to understand why we don't have those extra terms, very, very good. Thank you for the question. Oh, but I was planning to, because I think it's important. Because you see, something tricky is happening here. And we said that it was completely covariant. It was a tensor. It doesn't depend on a choice of foliation. But the shear, on the other hand, depends on a choice of foliation. Because there's no notion of shear without telling me on which cross sections you're projecting. So this formula cannot be arbitrary, of course. This is a very special formula determined by that choice of coordinates, because those choice of coordinates are actually introducing secretly a second background structure in the picture, which is a foliation of scry. So you have actually our background fields If we use Bondi coordinates, our background fields are omega and u. Because u is what is used to identify this foliation, and so what is this c? Remember that in general, to talk about the shear of an Alleper surface, you take Wald's book, it tells you, well, choose a deviation vector. And so because here the normal is n, let me call that deformation vector L, which already sounds like Neumann-Penrose formalism. And then,
can you draw what you call n and L?
Yes, yes. OK, so I know why you're asking me. So this is n, and this is minus L. Okay, that's because Neumann and Penrose conventions that they follow, n is kind of incoming, ingoing, L is kind of outgoing, and they're both future pointing. So that's kind of the feature that you will use. So this L, and so for a generic L, so what they have to satisfy is n dot L is equal to minus 1, and you have infinitely many of them. So if you think in terms of this Neumann and Penrose formalism, you have L, you have n, and here there's a sphere. You know that the Lorentz group of internal transformations of the metric, of the tetrad, you can split it. You can look at the little group of L, which is some iso 2 L. You can look at the little group of N, iso 2 N. They have in common the helicity and then two null translations. So let's say null translation L, null translation N. And then you also have boosts conjugated to this helicity here. So this, let me call it 3.
You're like a two-plane based on those normal vectors?
I'm just, for people familiar with the Neumann-Penrose formula, so you take this unphysical metric and you write it like this. And now, this is like a tetrad formalism, so this is exactly like writing this. And there isn't a unique choice of E for a given G. There's infinitely many which are parameterized by Lorentz transformations, isometries of these. The Lorentz transformations, it's convenient to decompose them into those that preserve L, those that preserve N, those that rotate M and M bar, and those that rescale L and N. And now, so I've learned Neumann-Penrose formalism in Chandra Segaran's book, and there he calls these things class 1 transformations, class 2 transformations, and class 3 transformations. I then realized that I'm probably the only one that uses these, but that's because I've learned them on that book. So class 1 transformations preserve L and change N. Class 2 transformations preserve N and change L. Class 3 transformations rescale L and N in an opposite way, so that n dot l equal minus 1 is preserved. Okay.
And the two-plane they act on is still the, and then like the transverse plane that ISO.
The transverse plane is, so the transverse plane now depends. Okay, so n, we keep it fixed once and for all. L, though, is arbitrary. As you move L in this little group orbit, you span all possible local hyperplanes. This freedom, you can partially freeze it by requiring that your Ls are all hypersurface orthogonal, so you span global planes. But then you still have lots of them, and so you still have freedom in doing these class 2 transformations, which basically is the freedom of choosing your L adapted to whatever foliation you've picked.
And then the iso 2 acts on that plane fixed by that foliation?
Or? The iso, so the L3 of the iso 2 then acts on this MM. Yes. Okay, so all of that was to say that when it, okay, so this is now, with this language, the shear is now defined, so sigma AB, let me call for short the spatial part of the metric. I'm going to use gamma mu nu, which is going to, the space, the AB components of this is just QAB. But you know, this is a four-dimensional object. QAB is not. So that's why, to avoid confusion, I prefer two different letters. But if you specialize to the cross sections, then it's the same thing as QAB. On the other hand, QAB doesn't, okay, no, that's it. That's what I want to say, sorry. And then, sorry. And then you take the traceless part of this, DC, L, D, and this gives you the shear. This D, you can replace it with the conformal D. I don't know where that went, up there. But if you use this language as a bi, you think of it as a 3D Carolian connection. Rigging independent Carolian connection, you can just write D, or you write conformal nabla, is the same thing. So which is the sigma that gives me CAB? Well, you take, we have, as we were saying, a special foliation, U. So you take L equal minus DU, minus because of this orientation condition. You take this, and then you learn that for this choice, this guy is minus 1 half delta A CAB. So that's great, because we now know what geometrically that flux means. It means that we have the new tensor, but only on round spheres, so that we can get rid of this guy. And we have the shear of a certain foliation. Now, what Laurent was referring to is what happens if you change foliation. And in fact, in the paper with Abai, you can find a very weird, possibly even ugly, if you want, relation between the news and the shear. And what matters is, you called it twist. For me, more than twist, it's important to think of it as the lead dragging. You see that du has the property that is lead dragged by n. But in general, you could pick an L which is not lead dragged. And now if you use Newman-Penrose notation, the Newman-Penrose coefficient for this lead dragging is tau. And so the general expression between an arbitrary shear and the news is some ugly expression, li n sigma b with a factor of 2. Right, it was a factor of 2, maybe here. And then things like dA plus 2a to b, and I don't remember, then there's something like 2 li n, no, sorry, L li n of 2, something like this, and then Gerok. So this is the general expression that Laurent was referring to. It's not hard to prove it, but it's true that it's ugly. On the other hand, what is not ugly about it? Well, anyway. Okay, fine. Well, actually, in the paper with Abai, I think we give the derivation, although probably he has removed some details.
That is sure is that you have 4 minutes.
Okay, fine, I don't mind. But I just want you to appreciate the beauty of this formula. So, because even though it looks ugly, it is beauty in a conceptual sense. Because you see, this guy is completely conformal invariant and foliation. So let me talk about foliation dependence.
This is a new bonding positivity. Sorry, never mind, I'm sorry.
And conformal invariance. This guy has both. What happens here? Well, suppose that you choose, so when you do a conformal transformation, you see that you could map L into omega L. If you do this, this guy is conformal invariant, but this guy is not, and therefore this piece compensates the conformal invariance, the non-conformal invariance of this guy, because this guy is already conformal invariant. Why do you need it? Now, the reason why you need it is that this guy, on the other hand, is not class 2 invariant. It depends on your choice of foliation. So what removes the dependence on the choice of foliation that this guy clearly doesn't have is this piece. So when you look, this was conformal invariance. So these two compensate each other for the lack of conformal invariance. Whereas if you look at class 2 invariance, this is not, this obviously is. And so these two do that job. So that's why you need this crappy formula. Because this gets rid of the class 2 dependence of this guy, but introduces a conformal dependence, which this guy removes, or vice versa. This guy is conformal invariant, but then is not foliation invariant, and so you have to introduce this. And how do you get rid, can you consistently get rid of these terms? Yes, because L is only defined up to a class 2 transformations, and so you're always free to change your conformal rules for L so that L picks up an inhomogeneous term so that it preserves the fact that 2 is equal to 0. So 2 equal to 0 can be preserved requiring L to transform non-homogeneously under conformal transformation. This is a class 2 piece that you use to adapt to the new foliation that you obtain when you do the conformal transformation. And then you can systematically, you can get rid of these two terms. And in that setup, the new tensor is just given by 2 Li N sigma AB minus rho AB. And this is what you find in, for instance, in the Dreyer-Streubel papers. This is the definition they use on news. You look at it and you say, why the hell they're doing that, which is not the general case? Well, that's because you can consistently do it. But you have to be careful about how L transforms. And now, to finish with something cute, because L has to transform like this, the shear cannot transform in a homogeneous way. Because if L was transforming like this under conformal transformations, then the shear would transform like this. But because L is transforming like this, the shear has to transform in a more complicated way. Guess what that more complicated way is? Well, it's what you get from these inhomogeneous terms here and here. Well, yeah, it's what you get from this part here. So this transformation here, which we know it can be interpreted as Li derivative plus anomaly. Remember this construction? This construction is really beautiful, is really powerful. The anomaly tells you how your field transforms if you don't touch the metric, if you only touch the background fields. And so if you look at the anomaly part of this, it's telling you how the shear transforms when you change omega and when you change u. But you have to do it in such a way that tau remains zero. And that's how you can predict that transformation rule without having to compute it in the standard way. Not only that, but that's also how you give the finite version of this transformation rule. And in exactly the same way, you understand why M has this crappy transformation rule. This is not at all a crappy transformation rule. This is exactly the right transformation rule that M must have. And the reason why it looks so crappy is that M is not a scalar. M is the time component of the energy momentum vector. And once you understand that, you have your transformations rules like that. You know how this vector transforms under changes of background. And you can predict the transformation rule of M by just understanding that if you change the foliation, well, what you call U component of your vector has to change. That's why you have these inhomogeneous terms here. So that gives so there's a little bit of puzzle in the literature because sometimes this is called non-covariant. It can be called covariant. So to clarify your head, you see, these are perfectly covariant transformations insofar as you're studying how things transform when you change the metric and the background fields. But you're interested in things that are invariant under changes of background fields, and that's why you would call these transformations rules non-covariant. So the language can be confusing, but you see the geometry is clear. This transformation rule acts on both dynamical fields and the background fields, and you can clearly separate the two. And the one that acts only on the background fields, we call it anomaly, and is what allows you to study the conformal weight and the foliation weight of your fields and check if things are covariant or not in that sense. And just so last sentence that I say, that you can use the criterion to uniquely identify this choice of charges as the ones that are covariant in this sense. They don't depend on background structures, and therefore their algebra closes without co-cycles in a very nice way.
The MP is not the same as the M.
This M rho is M minus 1 over 8 rho C. So on round spheres is the same thing as M. And it is the U component of Gerhardt's supermomentum tensor.
And there is no ambiguity in your J.
Now J, yeah, there's no ambiguity in J either. Although the status, so J is a little bit trickier. So J, this J is the Dreyer-Streubel. So this J, there's no ambiguity, is just, what is it? Psi 1 plus crop shear plus crop shear, right?
Okay.
That's what it is. That's the only choice you can make that is covariant, that comes from a symplectic potential. It's a little bit trickier than this guy, because it is slightly less covariant than this guy, in the sense that this guy is fully class 2 invariant, the integral of m rho. So it's really covariant. This Gerock already proved. The angular momentum is not fully covariant in the sense that you must choose your L adapted to the cross-section on which you make the integration. Whereas for Gerock tensor, it doesn't matter. You can choose L not associated to the cross-section you're integrating on. And that doesn't matter because the difference between the two is a boundary term. So it integrates out. But for angular momentum, you cannot do that.
Thank you.
You didn't have time to comment on that, but you know, if you just look at DNS and not, let's say, the generalized version, then YA is only, you know, is only a subset of functions, like six functions. So therefore, that integral has an infinite dimensional kernel.
Yes.
Right? So for BMS, in fact, it's much, I mean, it's like, what is GA? It doesn't make any sense. But the only thing that makes sense to ask that question when you look at a generalized BMS. Maybe you can explain that.
Yeah, I can, but. Unfortunately, my viewpoint at the moment on that is that that is just not a good question to ask. Because, but I understand what you're saying, and it's true. All you're saying is true. The point is that anyways, these aspects, there's no way to make them covariant. So talking about aspects is really tricky. One should be satisfied in talking about just charges.
Yes,
if you really want to talk about aspects, it's tricky because anyway, you will be forced to have some non-covariance.
You don't talk about the aspect, you talk about the charges. So it doesn't matter what the aspect is because most of it is zero.
Well, yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that, no, I care about the aspect, and in fact, I spent the last 2 weeks trying to understand if I can make the aspects covariant, but it seems to me that that cannot work, that you cannot make the aspects covariant, and therefore, it's very tricky to talk about aspects. So maybe it's not the right thing to do in the end. It would be nice, but maybe it's not the right thing to do. No, even in BMS, you cannot make them covariant.
Yeah, but I don't care, because the only thing that covariant is the charge. Right?
So exactly, yes.
The charge.
Yes.
I mean, you can write an equation that if I take GA, and I GA to be the derivative DB of TAB, so there's an infinite dimensional equivalence.
Sure. But the point is that none of them gives you a notion of covariant aspect. So, even though I think it's super nice to talk about the aspects, and as far as the Gerock is concerned, you can, it's very covariant. But for the angular momentum, anyway, you know, you will always have some co-cycle type of things in the transformation rules. Whereas for the charges, you can get rid of that, including generalized BMS and eBMS. But these I haven't talked about it. But for the aspects, even for standard BMS, there's not a unique choice in that infinite C. That will give you, just to write the equation to answer your question, you know, you would like something that the anomaly of the charge comes only from chi, right? The formula you would like is this. And what we showed in the paper with Antoine is that for the currents, you have this. Well, Zupas guarantees you this property, which you can then show it gives you no cocycle in the currents algebra. But for the charges, you know, you're only gonna get this for the charge aspect, sorry. You're only gonna get this up to some closed form. And now what happens is that if you integrate on cross sections, then you can show under some circumstances that this doesn't spoil covariance. But if you wanted the aspects themselves to be covariant, you would like to get rid of things like this entirely or make them some, you know, a central extension. That even for BMS, this is not possible. So Yeah, maybe you can find it. Like, we failed. We couldn't find it for the aspects. Only for... Actually, no, maybe you like this. We could find it for the Gerock supermomentum aspect, but one has to use compares covariant shear and use this Goldstone mode. And for the angular momentum, doesn't seem... So I completely like the quest of looking for aspects more than just the charges. But my viewpoint at the moment is that the currents are perfectly well defined, can be made very nicely covariant. The charges, to some extent, can. But the charge aspects seems to be more tricky. You know, in fact, I mean, even these is not the right. I mean, if you start to look at the aspects, these are not the quantities you have to look for. You have plenty of boundary terms that you must include, which, for instance, explain this piece of the transformation rule. So if you stop integrating the aspects, you have to start including these boundary terms, which you can. That's what allows you to make it work for Gerock. But for the angular momentum, it seems...
Other questions for Simone?
Maybe I have a very quick one. Do you refrain to call L an Erdmann connection because Charles Erdmann did you something wrong in your life?
Did he when? So.
I was very surprised by the way you went and was waiting for.
I gave my history. I'm just learning. I'm very, you know, limited. I'm just using Neumann-Penrose formalism. If I have absolutely nothing against it. I have absolutely nothing against it.
Absolutely. Just to check whether it was on purpose.
Maybe it's not a question that you mentioned at the end. You did mention that, you know, I mean, it's mostly related to the Weyl tensor.
Yeah, I said that briefly, but this you find in the every review of Abai. You start from the Weyl components. In fact,
you refrain from writing one.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know which one we write. I would say, so you look at the magnetic part of the rescaled Weyl tensor contracted with N. And this gives you psi 4, psi 3, and im psi 2. And so this is, but actually, no, but this, maybe it's nice that you say it, because actually this the Abai's connection contains more information than this. It also connects, it also knows information about the electric part of the shear. And that is why you can construct this covariant shear. So. Yeah, that's, I don't know if maybe which formula wanted me to write, but.
maybe let's have a coffee, right?
Yeah,
thank you. Type 4 in the end.
Ah, yeah. Oh, you know, but like this is the N, and no, sorry. This is N, by the way, this is interesting because yes. It screwed us. Because you see, it's a bloody non-local relation. Namely, knowledge of the new tensor, it is equivalent to knowledge of psi 4 and psi 3, but it's completely non-local. If you want to know the new tensor here, you have to know the curvature everywhere. And that is so annoying. There's a section of Penrose that says, that means that you cannot localize energy of gravitational waves.
The part that you missed there is like the kernel of that is roughly the vacuum. So like when you use solutions where both of those are zero, right?
So nu is equal to zero means that psi 3 is zero and psi 4 is zero.
Sure.
Typically, when you define non-radiative, you also require that this is zero. So that's on top of nu is equal to zero.
Combining those two leaves you with like super rotations and super translations.
So you mean I'm imposing also this to be zero?
Yeah.
So if you impose everything to be zero, all you have left is the electric shear.
And some super rotation also.
Well, I don't know what you mean, but. So all you leave in the connection degrees of freedom, so a vacuum connection, meaning that this is zero, this is zero, this is zero, is purely shear, which means that a vacuum connection, the shear of a vacuum connection, you can write it. There's this cool formula, dd plus rho over 2 Goldstone mode minus u row half.
Sure, but like
this
when,
is the
when you say non-local, like the fact that there are like basically sub-degrees of freedom that are not like determined by those two. Right?
But they are in the connection, those sub-degrees of freedom. So when Abai talks about the radiative phase space, the radiative phase space knows about the electric shear, knows about the soft modes.
Sure.
It's a little bit more than radiative.